walking wounded. Late morning, but there's a heaviness to it like dusk. Bruised sky like an eye swollen shut. Smell of sulfur in the warm wind from the lake, shallow at this end, rotted with cattails, tall reeds and rushes, and something floating just beneath the surface, sodden like old clothes. He has returned to our small town on Lake Cattaraugus. He has returned eviscerated. He is 41 years old. His youth has been lost to him. Torn away like clothes cut off a stricken man by EMTs wielding shears in an emergency. He has learned respect for the astonishing swiftness of young, vigorous emergency workers. As soon as you lose control of your body in a faint in a public place, their body is yours. Why think of this? He isn't. At the southernmost edge of the lake, he sees her, a luminous figure in the mist that lifts from the lake on this mild, overcast June morning. She is standing at a railing of the esplanade, very still. He is very still, a little distance away. Her back is to him, yet he is certain she's a stranger. Her hair is loose, curly, and tangled partway down her back. Her shoulders are narrow. She has delicate bone. A young woman, a girl, who he is sure a stranger to him. She leans forward against the wrought iron railing, gazing out at this lake in utter stillness. Light glooming on the rippled slate-colored water that seems almost to encase the woman. Or is it moisture in his eyes as he stares? He's so deeply moved. Is it her? Like a clapper inside a bell, his heart clamors. Am I terminal? He'd ask. Should I have hope? Or is that ridiculous, selfish? Early that morning, he'd been awakened by a sharp cramp in the calf muscles of his left leg, jolted from the comfort of sleep that's like a wave of drunkenness washing over him. He has learned to get quickly out of bed, stamp his bare foot on the floor to soothe the cramp, whispering to himself, the pain is excruciating. Within a minute or two, the worst of the pain usually fades. Like a rueful afterthought, the muscle ache will remain for hours. Since his evisceration, L has longed for sleep. It is his only refuge. Insomniac nights he'd resisted drugs and alcohol. He knows how easy that would be, stepping into the dark water that rises to his knees, his mutilated lower body, over his mouth, nose, eyes. No. Sleep is his happiest time, even when it's riddled with turbulent and senseless dreams, like that nightmare painting of Goya, Saturn devouring his children. As a boy, he'd been a runner. He'd been on the track team of the local high school. His leg muscles had cramped then sometimes, but this was different, a different kind of pain, a shared pain. The other boys on the team had had cramps in their calves, too. That was my life then, when I had a life. But there is no woman. He is lucky. No one sharing his bed to be a witness to the way such stabbing pain unmans him, renders him helpless as a child. What's a man without pride unmanned? Fact is, he could not bear another knowing of his condition. He told no one. He'd avoided the telling. Bluntly, he'd said to her, "No, I don't love you." It was a misunderstanding. Doesn't recall the look in her face. He turned away. And now he has returned to the house of his childhood at Lake Cattaraugus, New York. Even if she knew, she would not have dared follow. Just go away, leave me, and don't touch me. Your touch makes me sick. He has confided in no one, of course, because further there's no one. Just tell me, doctor, am I terminal? He'd been blunt, brave. It had seemed a kind of braveness, or possibly he'd been rude. In fact, he had not asked about hope. He had not even thought of hope at that time. The doctor's answer was unhesitating. No, you are not terminal, not inevitably. What the doctor meant that was with the proper medical treatment, of course, life is prolonged. Some sort of life is prolonged. After 5 years, he was told, there's a 65% survival rate for individuals in his age group afflicted with his particular cancer, if the cancer has not metastasized to lymph nodes or other organs or bone. If surgery removes the malignancies, if treatment can be tolerated, which sometimes, even in seemingly healthy and fit individuals, it is not. 9 months of chemotherapy following the radical surgery, the evisceration. He does not recall the surgery clearly, days, weeks immediately following. The relief of being alone, not having to speak of the considerable physical trauma, seeing its reflection in another's concern and pitying face. Grateful then he hadn't been married. To be wed to another is to be welded to another, and when you are mad to be alone, you do not wish to be either. So, El is alone with his body. If he is wed, weld to anything, it is to this body. If he examines his ravaged body, still he does not clearly recall the partially healed, shiny white scar tissue, like the configurations of frost on the window pane, the disfigurement of his lower belly and groin that suggests a playful distortion. A mist has settled over his brain. It's very easy to forget or misremember. By day, he has become brisk and matter-of-fact in his dealings with others. He is hearty-seeming, quick to laugh and quick to cease laughing, inclined to impatience. On the phone, he is assertive. His laughter is a kind of barking punctuation. Though he does not ever lift the receiver of a ringing phone unless he sees that it is a professional contact who is calling, an editor perhaps. Not the personal, but the impersonal is his solace. By day, when his clothes conceal the mutilation, very quickly you learn to adjust to the new contours of the body, disguised by ordinary loose-fitting clothing. As a person afflicted by joint pain learns to walk with his weight distributed just so no limp is detected. He is somewhat proud of such adjustments. By day, deals with himself briskly and matter-of-factly as another might deal with him, this body he has become. And what's most funny, how his teenage self would have recoiled in disbelief and loathing foreseeing such a fate. How once with a ninth grade friend watching a documentary of wounded and disabled Vietnam veterans in wheelchairs, El had said with the vehemence of youth, if anything like that ever happened to him, he would, quote, blow my brains out with a shotgun. You don't, though. A bashed watchword of the walking wounded. You don't. And so it has been a shock to Elle this morning, having seen the young woman at the lake, having felt for her something. She's a stranger, he's certain. No one who has known Elle or Elle's family. The luminous figure, so still. Elsewhere in the park were teenagers, adults with young children, even a boy with a model airplane. Their noises did not seem to penetrate the silence that enveloped the young woman. She stood apart from them as if invisible. Curly, tangled hair partway down her back, very fine, very pale, silvery pale, with a mineral sheen, and wearing what appeared to be a sweater or a wrap of some pale gray cobwebby material, and her white linen skirt long, nearly to her ankles, and her bare feet in open-toed sandals, white skin. From a little safe distance, he regarded her. Almost he was waiting to be disillusioned, to see that, yes, this was not a young woman, but someone he knew had gone to school with long ago. Worse yet, the daughter of an old Cattaraugus classmate. But he did not know her, he was certain. She is new to this place also. That stab of excitement and recognition, it can leave you shaken, faint, and electric current running through the torso to the groin, the vagus nerve. If the shock is severe, the nerve shuts off blood to the brain and you fall at once in a faint. Hello, he might plausibly have called to her. Excuse me, he might have approached her. His heart beats strangely just to think so. A shock to him at his age and in his condition, who was expected to see nothing at Lake Cattaraugus and to feel nothing. Hello, don't think I've seen you here before. I used to live in Cattaraugus, now I return. Oh, ridiculous. Such words, faltering, stale, hopeless, and contemptible. Flung after him the cruel female taunt. Go away, you're not even a man. Why would I want to speak to you? Chloroform is the most pragmatic. Swift, clean, leaves no trace, and he knows where to purchase it without being questioned. Other methods are cruder, clumsier. Within the past several years, he has perfected his method. The primary element is surprise and, of course, no witnesses. He has grown deceitful. It is a rare pleasure, returning to the family home at Lake Cattaraugus and telling no one who knows him. Not relatives in the area, not family friends, old friends from school. Well, returning wounded and wise in deception, armed with a project, a manuscript of more than 1,000 pages that requires his deepest concentration. For happiness is not fixed but alterable. For some, happiness is the ability to draw a deep breath without recoiling in pain. Happiness is a little stoma that is not reddened and infected but functioning perfectly. In a small town, however, it's not possible to remain secluded for long. The more you wish to hide from us, the more we wish to seek you out. Hello? Sorry, can't talk right now. Yes, it's been years. We'll call you back. Busy time, can I call you back? Yes, just for the summer, thanks, but work, no, don't think so. Work, deadline, September 1st. Sorry, somebody at the door. Swiftly and deftly, the chloroform-soaked cloth is pressed over her mouth, nose. She fights him bravely, desperately. He will see her eyelids flutter. He will see the light go out in her eyes, but she will not have seen his face. Within seconds, her limbs grow limp, surprising heaviness of the limp, slender body, as if death is an icy lava flowing into her bones. He has not been seeking her. He has avoided the lakeside park. He's been avoiding even thinking of her. And so he isn't prepared. He sees her for the second time, entering the Cattaraugus Public Library. A glimmering figure in white at dusk in the heat of summer of upstate New York, there's a moist heaviness to the air that seems to gather like an electric charge with the waning of the light in the sky. And it is at this time he sees her, not certain at first if it is her, a tall, pale, gliding figure, and her tangled silvery hair partway down her back. Without a backward glance at Elle, who stands stunned and breathless on the flagstone walk outside the library staring at her, should he follow her into the library as if by chance? Or he should continue past the library as if he has no business in the library at all. The Cattaraugus Public Library is a small library housed in the first floor of a gaunt, faded red brick colonial on Courthouse Square. The Historical Society next door is darkened, but the library is still open at 7 p.m. This is the first time since his return to Cattaraugus that Elle has revisited the library, and it is both gratifying to him and a little disturbing that the library has changed so little over the years. All of central upstate New York has been locked in a recession for decades. Still, the Cattaraugus County Public Library retains the power to excite Elle with the prospect of a new adventure, a book he has not read yet, an author of whom he hasn't heard. Elle experienced his first sense of the forbidden in the rear of the library, where as a boy, he'd been looking through novels in the section marked adult fiction, and a frowning librarian had surprised him skimming impenetrable pages of James Joyce's Ulysses. "Excuse me, what is your age?" His age? He'd been 12 or 13 at the time. The prim-faced middle-aged woman with staring eyes had known very well that the trembling boy, she apprehended, was hardly 18. She'd taken the forbidden book from him, shut it, and replaced it on a shelf. Abashed, he'd fled. Elle smiles, recalling that had been a long time ago, when anything in any library could be forbidden to him. Now he's standing on the walk outside the library. It is near dark. The gaunt old brick house is lighted from within, and he can see a few figures, a display of books, but he can't see her. In a trance of indecision, he's been debating whether or not to enter the library. He thinks he can simply ignore the woman. She's a stranger to him, and truly, she is nothing to him. Still, he feels hesitation. A part of his brain cautions him against behaving recklessly. The library is small, cramped. It's not really possible to avoid other patrons if they're in the front area as you enter. He feels a visceral dread of getting too close to the woman with the shimmering, silvery hair, for fear that he will unwittingly call attention to himself, and she will see him staring at her, and if she sees him, she will know. Oh, but what will she know? Something. Something she will see in his face? A premonition of something that will happen, or something that will never happen, or something that has already happened. He decides not to enter the library. He finds himself walking along a darkened pathway beside the library, staring into the windows as he passes. He sees several figures, but not the silvery-haired woman. Then at the rear window, he sees her, her back to the window. She's leaning over an oversized book like an atlas, Probably it is, as he recalls, the American Gazetteer, a 19th century book of maps kept with other smaller, similar in the atlases in the corner of the reference section. He sees the woman's slender arm, her fingers turning to oversized parchment-like page. He sees silver filaments in her hair that falls in tangled waves of her shoulder. He can see the side of her face just barely, the curve of her cheek, her parted lips. The scene is brightly lit from within. Only a few yards away, he is standing in darkness, invisible. The sharpness of Vermeer, he thinks. He feels a yearning in the region of his heart so powerfully, he is almost faint. Why is a young woman interested in that old book? As a boy, he'd paged through atlases in the library and examined the globe that spun with geriatric slowness. Its carefully outlined countries were defined by colors outdated 30 years ago. How erotic the sight of the silvery-haired woman's arm as her sleeve slips down to her elbow, and the faint shimmer of her hair. Every movement of the woman is exciting to Elle, the more that she's unaware of him watching her so intently. She must never know. She must be protected from whatever is happening. At the rear of the library, he pauses. Here's a shadowy alcove, a pedestrian pathway. You might think he'd parked his car nearby, and he's a library patron like the others. He's positioned himself so that he can see not the front entrance of the library, but much of the front walk that leads to the street. No one can leave the library without being Samuel, he is certain. From his vantage point in the shadows, he observes a heavy-hipped woman leaving the library, a solitary man in shorts. It must be closing time, 7:30 on a weeknight in summer. He can't see anyone else inside except the librarian. Still, the silver-haired woman must be still in there. He seems to be waiting for her to leave the library after all, but he will not follow her. Under a hypnotic spell, time passes slowly for Elle. In fact, it is a pleating time. He is neither here entirely in the shadows, at the rear of the library, nor is he elsewhere. He is suspended in time. He wants to plead with the silver-haired woman. There has been some mistake. The person you see is not really me, what was done to me and what I have become. And a woman will turn to him and she will touch his arm gently. All of his senses are alert to the point of pain. He can scarcely breathe in anticipation of what she will tell him. Well, there's a jolt. Time has passed. Elle rouses himself to realize the library is empty, except the librarian who's switching off lights. How is this possible? Where is the silver-haired woman? He wants to protest. He could not have missed her. Not for a moment has he turned his gaze away from the front walk. He has scarcely dared to blink. Is it possible she left the library by another door? But there is no other door, he's sure. Only an emergency door at the rear that would sound an alarm if opened. He admonishes himself it is not possible that she left by the front door and he didn't see her. He could not have missed her. He peers inside, as would a husband, for instance, or a father waiting for someone to emerge from the library who has not emerged. However, there's no one there except the librarian, Mrs. McGarry. Hello, can I help you? I'm afraid we're closing just now. Doesn't Mrs. McGarry recognize him? He is older than she has ever seen him, of course. His once thick, dark hair is scanty, like thin like the feathers of very young birds not yet fledged. And perhaps he is grimacing impatiently, his face so contorted that Mrs. McGarry can't seem to recognize the boy who used to come to the library so often a lifetime ago. Oh, is it? The light of recognition comes into the white-haired woman's face. Now, Elle cannot escape. Mrs. McGarry speaks his name and greets him warmly. She's just locking up the library, she explains, switching off lights. Would he wait a moment? Of course, how can Elle possibly say no? I was a friend of your dear mother for many years. Yes, I know. Elle shakes her hand, a word shake it, but Mrs. McGarry extends her hand to clasp his in commiseration, perhaps. He is eager to escape, eager to drift away into the night in chagrin and shame and a kind of fury, except Mrs. McGarry retains him. The last time I saw you, I think Margaret and I had just returned from visiting Chloe Sanderson in the hospital. Poor Chloe, your mother brought her flowers from her garden, an armful of the most fragrant flowers. A bittersweet memory, a memory to be shared, a memory not to be avoided, and so Elle endures it with a stoic smile. Are you living in your parents' beautiful house now? I thought I'd heard this. Have you returned to us? Mrs. McGlary clutches at his hand. Her eyes search his with a discomforting intensity, and he sees that it is Mrs. McGarry, perhaps, who has been awaiting him in this place, and not the other. He wants to ask the librarian about the shimmering, silvery-haired woman who leaned over the old atlas. Who is she? Did Mrs. McGarry see her? He wants to ask her what she recalled of the boy he'd been, what his mother might have told him, her, of him. But the words choke in his throat. He can only smile and allow his hand to be clasped and stroked in consolation for his loss. Are you returned to us? He has no idea. He has his eye on the farther edge of the lake along the east shore. On one of his restless walks, he has scrutinized the area, the possibilities. His mind is always working, swift, sharp, like flashing scissors. He recalled from years ago and has reacquainted himself that fetid stretch of rotted cattails, fish floating belly up, broken styrofoam. Since he has no boat to row to lake, no motorboat, no way of assuring that the body will be far enough from shore, that the body will sink to a depth of more than 6 feet to lie against the mucky bottom of the lake, he will have to dump the body in a more convenient place. A highly challenging, very ambitious project for which I need seclusion here in Cattaraugus. So he has said. There was pleasure in such a statement made to the inquisitive. A shock to L, that deeply flattering, he'd been named executor of the literary estate of the distinguished writer-historian V.S., who died at 84 the previous December. Obviously, there'd been a mistake on someone's part, for L had not been contacted beforehand. No, would he have expected to be singled out for this honor that carries with it a good deal of responsibility? A call from a lawyer, congratulations from friends, his name in the obituary in the New York Times, also sudden and unexpected. He had just begun chemotherapy. Every 2 weeks for 4 hours in succession, poisons dripping into his veins and coursing through his heart, so lethal. The infusion room nurses had to wear protective clothing. Yet when S's lawyer called, L heard his voice crack with emotion. Oh, yes, of course, though I knew it's still a surprise and a great honor. Flush with this honor like a transfusion of fresh blood, L agreed to help S's editor prepare S's final book for publication in January of the new year. A biography of biographies will be a magisterial work, quote unquote. No doubt, the manuscript or manuscripts runs to 1,300 pages. S's editor, upset and aggrieved that the prominent elderly author had died before the book was quite ready for press, assured L that there was very relatively little work to be done. Like every other historian of the subject, he begins with Plutarch's Lives, but he ends arbitrarily in the early 1980s with Leon Edel's Henry James and Richard Ellman's James Joyce, as if these are the most recent biographies L had read. L had hoped to attach himself to a work of substance, even of genius, a work of literature that mattered. A posthumous collaboration with S would have lifted L's sodden spirits, even as it would have lifted his reputation. Not that he cares so much any longer for reputation at nearly 42. He's lived long enough without one. What did he hope for then, to live again through another, through the elderly S? He thinks he could give up, he could admit defeat, but he will not admit defeat. He is still alive. There's so much more work to do on the book than L had anticipated, but perhaps he tells himself it's good for him in his depressed and morbid state of mind. He's not so happy with S's editor, a prominent New York editor, much respected. L has patiently explained to S's editor that he prefers email exchanges to telephone conversations, yet the man continues to call him and never less than once a week. This is a particularly sort of harassment, L thinks, oblique but unmistakable. When the other day the editor called to ask L how his work on the book was progressing, L replied with a sardonic laugh, "Well, I'm hoping to stay alive long enough to finish it." S's editor was stunned into silence for a long moment, unsure how to respond to this remark. I don't understand. Are you ill?" "No, that was a joke." "Not a very witty joke. Immediately I regretted having made it." "Well, if you need an extension." "Oh, not at all. I will get the revised manuscript to you by naming the September 1st deadline he'd been given." thinking, are they hoping I will give up? Do they know that I'm a terminal case? Thinking, they don't really want to publish this book. A posthumous author is a lost cause. He knows that he will see the silvery-haired woman again. It is inevitable for him and for her, but he wishes it would not be inevitable for her. He does not want to hurt her. He does not even want to frighten her. He does want her to acknowledge him. She owes him, he thinks, that much, a beggarly gesture for which he will be absurdly and abjectly grateful. He has taken a hiking out to the lake via a Catamount Road. He's so restless. We have observed him at a distance. Some of us have outboard motors and rowboats. Some of us have canoes, though we don't canoe much in the muggy summer heat of the Finger Lakes region. Elle limps slightly, almost you would notice. She will not notice, Elle is determined, but he can limp quickly like a dog with three practiced legs. It is the largest and by tradition the most beautiful of the 11 Finger Lakes of central New York, Lake Cattaraugus. Indeed, it is oddly shaped like a finger, a beckoning finger, 40 miles long, south-north, 4 miles at its widest. The village of Lake Cattaraugus is the only populated area on the lake, though there are cottages and cabins scattering around it. Much of the eastern shore has reverted to the wild. Occasionally, there are boats on the lake, but the lake is quite deep at its center. Elle is intrigued to think that he sees a shimmering flash of silvery hair in one of the blinding white sailboats drifting past. Oh, she is with one or two others, a man and two men and a woman. He shades his eyes, but the figures fade in a haze of sunlight. Thinks he sees a young woman in a bathing suit on a deserted stretch of beach later that day. Not so slender as he imagined, but lanky-limbed and hard-muscled like a high school girl athlete. Her hair has been pulled back into a ponytail and seems to be lighter, wheat-colored. Distasteful to Elle that the beautiful girl is in the company of other cruder individuals her age, and all of them in bathing suits. He is shocked one of the loudish boys tugs at her ponytail. If he brought a rifle with him, well, why has he thought of a rifle? There is no rifle in his parents' house. He has not been brought up to use firearms. But no, that girl is not her. He is fully sane. He is not sick-minded. He knows this. Before the teenagers can see the white-skinned middle-aged man spying on them from behind a bank of cattails, he withdraws shrewdly. God help me. I cannot help myself. Today she has brought a book with her. She's seated on a bench overlooking the lake and engrossed in her book, as a young girl might be engrossed in the book in a long ago time. She is not in the place he'd seen her initially, for Elle has avoided that place. But immediately he recognizes her with a gut-sick sensation of certainty. His eyes swerves upon her. He will not see her face fully unless he approaches her and positions himself in front of her. It is quite natural that a visit to the park might stand at the lakeside rail in this way to look out, to toss bread crusts at an excited little flotilla of mallards and geese. No need to defend himself from accusers. But in doing so, he would probably draw the attention of the young woman, which he must avoid. How beautiful she is, how solitary. Speckled sunlight falls upon her like gold coins. He dreads violating that stillness. She's wearing a long skirt of some thin, silky fabrics, slit to the thigh, a startling sight. It is a provocative way of dressing, and yet, Elle thinks, it is a classic Asian style, an elegantly long skirt, unexpectedly slit to the thigh. What he can see of her leg, her thigh, is an expanse of very pale flesh, not muscular, but very lean. The tight, taut flesh of a young person. Her hair is less silvery than he recalls, more likely faded blonde, ash blonde, threaded with glinting hairs. Not so wavy curly today and falling straight past her shoulders. He feels his heart missing beats. He has had few cardiac problems. His doctors have been impressed. Such physical trauma to a man's body, such incisions, eviscerations, are more profound than simple physical injuries. But he has prevailed nonetheless. His heart has rarely failed him. But now his heart is hurting. He sees the book in which the young woman is engrossed is covered in transparent plastic, a book borrowed from the local library, no doubt, not a purchase of her own. He's just slightly disappointed that the young woman hasn't bought the book for herself. It's only a library withdrawal, suggesting that her commitment is ephemeral. He wonders what the title is. At the same time, he believes it would be better for him not to know. Knowing Curtail's desire from his former life when he'd been alive, he recalls. Still, he's excited to discover the woman. Until this moment, his day had been torturous, beginning with painful leg cramps at an hour before dawn. He has had to confront the fact his work is stalled. He sees himself in a vehicle stalled on railroad tracks, paralyzed as a locomotive rushes at him. He'd spent the day, in fact, several days, in a trance of frustration, so extreme it borders upon wonderment. Each morning, he hauls himself to his writing table, as you might haul a lifeless body. He works for lengthy hours, becoming increasingly fretful as the morning hours wane, and he has little to show for his effort. But with the appalling movement of the clock downward in the afternoon, he becomes ever more agitated, and it is very difficult for him to keep his mind from fastening onto her. He keeps his distance from the woman, who sits very still, almost unnaturally still. He tells himself it's all very casual. There's nothing urgent or fated about discovering her. There is a good side of the lake where the water is relatively clear of algae that grows elsewhere in thick, metastasizing slime clumps. All is calm today. The lake's surface reflects the sky dully like hammered tin. What is she reading? El's heart contracts with yearning. He wants badly to know. It is not a heavy book, not a long novel, nor does the cover suggest a popular bestseller. From time to time, the young woman glances up from the book as if it reminds her of something, a moment of tenderness, a private thought. But he will not approach her, he thinks. He will respect her privacy. But here is a rude surprise. Children are approaching. Middle school boys on bicycles loudly calling to one another. The calm of the lakeside has been shattered. The father in t-shirt, rumpled shorts, chiding a child who has displeased him in some trivial way. Elle tries not to stare at these intruders with a look of rage, thinking how much more beautiful it would be and more merciful if human beings did not utter words out of their contorted mouths, but sign them as the deaf do with precision and grace. He has frequently been impressed, indeed fascinated, by observing a deaf interpreter sign to an audience at a public event. It occurs to him that the silvery-haired woman whose voice he has never heard is a kind of sign. Her beautiful averted face, her shimmering hair, her slender and very still body. So absorbed in her book, the young woman seems scarcely aware of the intrusive family who have, to Elle's dismay, set down their picnic things on a nearby table. Only mildly annoyed, it seems the young woman glances around at the bickering family and for a dazzling, heart-stripping moment at him, but without quite seeing him, Elle thinks. Yet he has seen her. The impact of that face, those eyes, will remain with him for a long time. It is time to leave. On his shaky legs, Elle retreats. Chloroform makes of the most resistant body a very bride. The struggling hands, the clawing nails, the convulsive flarings of the limbs all surrender within seconds. Her lover tells her, please understand, I am providing a happy ending for you who will be protected from the terrible erosion of time. In my arms, you will always be young. You will always be my bride. You will always be worthy of love and loved. This is the second part. Evangeline. Oh, it's a beautiful name. He knew a girl with this name long ago in grade school, the daughter of a local minister who died or moved away. All I can recall of Evangeline is the girl's curly red gold hair, silver barrettes in the hair on the girl's profile. He'd sat behind her in fifth grade, an accident of the alphabet. He does not think that the silvery-haired woman is Evangeline, for that minister's daughter would be much older than this woman. That Evangeline's life would be much different from the life he can imagine for this woman. So often he finds himself thinking that persons of his generation, his age, whom he has not seen in some time, are probably not even alive now. Evangeline seems to tell him, we are all forgetting each other constantly. Life is a shimmering stream. The light plays on the stream through the trees for just a measured distance. Then it is gone, but the stream continues. We bask in the sunshine, then the sunshine is gone. But when the sunshine is gone, we are gone. So we don't feel a loss. We don't feel pain. Oh, it's not possible. No. Elle has made a shocking discovery in the manuscript. shocking to him, it seems unmistakable, the distinguished scholar, critic, historian, S., twice winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters for 40 years, seems to have plagiarized a part of a chapter on medieval saints' lives from a scholarly article available online through Google Scholar. The plagiarism is almost verbatim, though S. made of several paragraphs one single lengthy paragraph and substituted arcane words for plainer words. L. tells himself that S. intended to delete these passages at a later date. At least a skilled writer like S. would recast them more thoroughly so that their origins in the work of another scholar would not be so obvious, and there are no footnotes attributing the source. He decides that the wisest strategy for him is simply to delete the passages as if they never existed. S.'s editor has these files also, but L. doubts that S.'s editor will ever read through the massive manuscript, still less detect the plagiarized passages. It is urgent for L. to protect S., at least S.'s reputation. Problem is, deleting passages means that L. will have to provide a transition of some kind. He fears that he will be incapable of doing this, replicating L.'s elegant prose. And he can't help but wonder if S. had plagiarized elsewhere in the manuscript. His work as an indentured servant for the dead man will never end. He sees that now. Another, even more shocking discovery, after L. has been away from the manuscript for 48 hours, mixed in with S.'s scholarly writing is a kind of journal or diary, a very different kind of writing altogether, and L. thinks it must have been inserted in the manuscript by mistake. Chloroform is the most pragmatic. Swift, clean, leaves no visible trace, and he knows where to purchase it without being questioned. And swiftly and deftly, the chloroform-soaked cloth is pressed over her mouth, nose. She fights him desperately, bravely. He will see her eyelids flutter. He will see the light go out in her eyes, but she would not have seen his face. L. is appalled by what he reads, but he is excited as well. He has discovered approximately 40 pages of prose charting the stalking and murder of an identified woman. The prose is intense, intimate, obscenely poetic. It is possible that S. was writing a darkly erotic novel, a quasi journey tracking the obsession, disintegration of a personality resembling his own. But in all of his career, S. had never published fiction, so far as L. knew. What is particularly upsetting to L. is that the erotic material is in a section of the manuscript that S.'s editor was supposed to have read, but clearly had not. L. will have to delete those pages also. He won't allow himself to keep reading, but he will delete without reading. He must protect the elder writer who cannot protect himself. All must be hidden, erased. No one must know. Several mornings in succession, he is awakened by the sound of a woman or a girl sobbing. Hello, is someone there? Quickly, he rises from bed to investigate, his heart pounding in dread. Of course, it's no one. The wind in the trees surrounding the house. Strange, muffled cries of birds in the eaves. He listens. The mysterious sound has faded. Throughout the day, at wayward times, he thinks he hears the sound, but doesn't allow himself to be distracted. He concentrates on his work. And then to his chagrin, he discovers more of the offensive material he'd believe he'd deleted. Chloroform makes of the most resistant body a very bride. The struggling hands, the clawing nails, the convulsive flames of the limbs all surrender within seconds. In exasperation, L deletes this. How disgusting. He is left shaken, bewildered. He's plagued by the absurd yet appalling possibility that offensive material of this nature will remain in S.'s manuscript, hidden in the file, to be horribly printed and published in book form, embedded in the scholarly prose of a biography of biographies. What a scandal if this should happen. Hello, is someone there? He hears the sound of sobbing somewhere close by. He has just emerged from a wine store where he has bought a bottle of wine to bring to his parents' old friends one evening. Out of restlessness, he'd been walking and happened to see the wine store. He decides to make the purchase now rather than later, though it means carrying the wine bottle back up the hill to his house. Now in the parking lot beside the wine store, he thinks he hears the sound of sobbing, but when he turns to look, he sees no one. He's perplexed, but not especially frightened. For this is not happening inside his head, as he has sometimes feared when he hears a sound in the early morning in his house. It is not at all unlikely that a woman, a girl, a young boy might be sitting inside a vehicle in the parking lot, sobbing, and that L has happened to overhear. He listens closely. The sobbing seems to have faded. He walks on. He is feeling hopeful. The bottle has an attractive label. It is a Chilean Chardonnay, new to him. He will enjoy himself that evening, he is determined. It has been too long since Al has spent time with friends. He needs to engage in conversation. He needs to laugh. He needs to forget about S, and he needs to forget about E. He will deflect questions that seem to him too private, too personal. He will do it in a discreet way. Have you returned to us? We have been waiting for you for years. He has left the wine store parking lot, and we turn to Rhodes End Lane. Already it is late afternoon, past 5 o'clock. He must return home. He must shower and cleanse himself thoroughly before going out. He has a fear of offending the nostrils of others who know nothing of his secret and must not guess it. Walking in a neighborhood in Cattaraugus that is not familiar to him, he finds himself crossing a pedestrian bridge, a very old bridge. To his left, just visible through a maze of wood frame houses, is a stretch of slate-colored Lake Cattaraugus. To his right is a sprawling New York Central Railway, desolate at this hour. Ahead, he sees a young woman at the bridge railing, leaning her elbows on the railing, as if she is very tired. Her long, tangled hair falls forward, hiding her face, it seems to him, and a grieved face, though he cannot see it clearly. It is this woman who has been sobbing, is it? Al stops dead in his tracks at the sight of her. He will recall afterward he had no choice but to approach her to ask if anything is wrong. Excuse me, hello? The young woman doesn't seem to have heard him. Already she has turned away. She's walking away, a stricken creature, wounded, wincing with pain, he thinks. She does not want him to see her face. Is she crying? Is she ashamed that she is crying? He sees that she is wiping at her face with both hands as she hurries away. He thinks, but I have no choice. The woman is wraith-like, very thin. She seems scarcely to be walking or running, but rather gliding. She wears a long, dark skirt. She wears a shawl wrapped about her shoulders. He can't see her face and so has no idea how old she is, but her movement suggests that she is young and lithe. Her hair is a shimmer of hues, blonde, ash blonde, wheat silver, that flies about her head as if galvanized by electricity. Al doesn't quit in his pace. He will not overtake the woman. If she needs help, if she needs protection, he will be close behind her, but he does not want to frighten her. He keeps a fixed distance between them, 30 feet perhaps. I am here if you need me. I am always here, that is all. Al follows the woman across the street of badly broken pavement. He follows her into a vacant lot behind a block of brownstone row houses. Here there is underbrush, discarded and rotted lumber, broken clay pots, and empty bottles. Al has become confused, so what is this fetid place? Where is the young woman leading him? Hey, you! Out of the rubble, an angry man approaches Al. He is fast and springy on the balls of his feet. He is belligerent and menacing as a pit bull. Al is taken totally by surprise. Naively, he glances over his shoulder to see if the angry man is addressing someone behind him. But it is Al at whom the angry man is staring with stark, protuberant eyes. It is Al at whom he is speaking in disgust. I said you. What do you want? The flush-faced man, a decade younger than Al, not taller than Al, but thicker bodied, is bearing upon him with a look of fury. Al would turn away and flee, but Al doesn't want to retreat in the face of the other's irrational anger, for he is thinking that will violate his integrity. Also, he does not dare turn his back on such anger. The man spits at him. You sick fuck. What the fuck do you think you're doing following her? Now it is clear. The man is in alliance with the unhappy young woman. Al would explain that he meant no harm. He was only seeing if the woman needed help. He did not mean to upset her. He is sorry if he was misunderstood. But the angry man isn't interested in anything else, as to say. He has stepped boldly close to Al, and he continues cursing Al. To his chagrin, Al sees that the young woman has taken a position behind the man. As if Al presents such a threat to her, she has to hide behind the angry man. At the same time, the woman herself has become defiant, flushed with indignation. Oh, that's certainly not Evangeline, Al sees now. She is no one he has seen before. She has small, crushed together features, but she is not at all delicate bone. Her hair has a coarse, metallic sheen. Her bony upper chest is exposed, her pallid skin. In an insensate, infantile voice, she tells the angry man that this is the person who's been following her and scaring her. That son of a bitch is always following me. This is him. Before El can protect himself, the angry man rushes at him and strikes him in the face. It is a powerful, stunning blow. El feels his left eye socket crack. He staggers backward. The angry man has wrenched the wine bottle out of El's hand and threatens to strike him with it. Hey, don't break this, for Christ's sake. Deftly, the young woman detaches the wine bottle from her companion's fingers. El would retreat, but the angry man won't let him. El dares not turn his back for fear he will be murdered. He tries to defend his bleeding face as a child might with his elbows and uplifted arms. But the angry man continues to pursue him, not so hurriedly now, almost randomly striking him with sharp blows, his chest, his shoulder, his left temple. El can barely see. Both his eyes have been struck, his vision blotched by pinpoint hemorrhages. No, please don't. El tries to protest, but his mouth has been wounded. His lower lip has been savagely slashed. He would stagger away in desperation, but the angry man refuses to let him. The wrath of this stranger seems to be building, like that of a vengeful god. The more he punishes his victim, the more furious he is with his victim. El's very blood on his hands, splatting his clothing, is a goal to him, a provocation. A forlorn thought comes to El belatedly. Your mistake was leaving home today on foot. El is knocked to the ground by the angry man's pounding fists. It is a mistake to fall to the ground, for now the angry man is angrier and is kicking El, grunting, cursing, kicking. The angry man is a flame that cannot be quenched, that must burn itself out, kicking the falling El in the ribs without mercy. El feels the bones cracking that protect his heart and lungs. He is writhing in pain. He is pierced with pain as a steel blade. The tangled-haired woman is taunting him, not trying to save him from the angry man, but has become his assailant too, bent upon vengeance. El wants to ask, why? And now it is worse, it is unbearable. El is being kicked in the stomach, in a terrible wound in his lower belly that has not yet healed, in the stoma that bleeds so easily, a mere touch can start it bleeding, and the terror is of bleeding to death. He can't draw breath to explain. He is unable to speak. The angry man will not let him speak, and the angry young woman will show him the mercy. They have confused El with someone else. Is that it? He wants to protest, to plead with him. His wrong man they are punishing. But in his agony, he can't draw breath to speak. And then suddenly he is alone. His assailants have departed. It is very quiet, except for El's gasping breaths. One of them has taken his wallet, torn it from inside his blood-soaked trousers. El is alone, flat on the ground, in the tin-colored sky, close overhead like something that is shutting. The pain continues to build. Behind his blinded eyes, the flame grows in intensity until there's nothing but the hot, blinding, searing flame that develops him and is him. No ID? Who is this? Jesus, looks like somebody was real mad at the poor bastard. So this is part three, which is very short. Three. Hello. Her eyes lift to his. He can't see her face clearly, but he can see that she is smiling at him shyly. He believes that she is smiling at him. They're in a secluded place that smells of the lake, rotted algae, carcasses of fish mummified in the summer sun. He sees a fleeting shadow on the ground, the shadow of a large bird, a predator, or rather a scavenger, with wide, dark, awkward wings. He does not know if this is a turkey vulture. He knows that there are turkey vultures in Cattaraugus County. The bird is too large to be a crow or a raven. It is not flying, but rather walking with ungainly steps. It is walking toward him. Its eyes are bronze and unwinking. Its beak looks sharp and it is long enough to reach his heart. The silvery-haired woman is close by. This is Evangeline, he is certain. But perhaps she does not want to be called that name. Perhaps that is a secret name, not to be uttered. She's not so close that he can reach up to touch her, to clutch at her hand as he wants so badly to do. For if he could clutch her hand, if she would grip his hand firmly, she might pull him up onto his feet. Badly, he wants to be raised to his feet. He is in despair of what has happened to him. And it will be the first step in making things right and returning to his normal life if the young woman will help him to his feet, if she will offer him her hand. She is not so close that he can see her face clearly or her eyes. He senses that her eyes are veiled, but he sees that she is there. She has not abandoned him. Gently she says to the fallen woman, to the fallen man, "Oh, love, give me your hand." I think you're.